Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. We're trying something new today on the program. Even if you're a regular listener, you may not have been aware that to date, all of my conversations have taken place with the guest sitting directly in front of me. Today's guest, however, Bob Fry, joins me from a studio in Manhattan. Bob is a former executive producer for ABC News and more recently a film producer and director. He's on the program because his most recent film, In My Lifetime, a documentary about the nuclear arms race and the struggle for disarmament, will air on WCNY this coming Friday, June 14th at 10 p.m. Bob also has local roots. He grew up in the Syracuse area, graduated from Fayetteville Manlius High School, and in fact, made a documentary about one of his high school reunions. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Grant. I'm pleased to be with you.
Well, let me just start with a basic question. Why did you decide to make the film when you did?
It's interesting. I was going back through notes. In 2006, I wrote a note to myself, make a film about nuclear weapons. And then in 2007, through a series of meetings, I had gone to some talks, one given by Richard Rhodes, and it sort of spurred my interest. And at the same time, as you know, in this world, funding is a very essential part of it. And I'd met with the woman who was the initial funder of the project. And so those two things coincided. And then with the Wall Street Journal op-ed pieces by Secretary Shultz and what became known as the Four Horsemen, the interest in the topic became more relevant, I think. I ended up in Oslo filming in February of 2008, and from there the story goes.
Well, on that note about the Secretary Shultz connection, and he's featured in your film, I was curious to know whether you think that with the focus on terrorism as a threat and our experiences of those kinds of attacks, are we in danger of forgetting about or losing touch with the level of destruction of a nuclear conflict?
I think the answer is regardless of what happens, how it happens, if it does happen, and as you appreciate, you can scare people by making a film or you can inform people. And what I've tried to do within my lifetime is to inform and to realize that this story goes back to its roots, really, 1945, after the Manhattan Project created the weapon. We still haven't figured out how to deal with this. It's what I consider to be an ongoing struggle. But I think today, the reality of having 18,000 nuclear weapons available in the world, which is an enormous amount of firepower, combined with the unpredictable nature of life, forget about the unpredictable nature of the use of weapons, compelled me to tell this story. And whether it's considered an act of terrorism, and again, I think it is very difficult for someone, as they are benignly called non-state actors, to get their hands on weapons or the materials. The fact that there are 9 nuclear weapon states, and although there are controls, it still is, I think, a dangerous situation that we find ourselves in the world. And my goal with the film was just to inform and hopefully create a dialogue around this whole topic.
And how did you pick the title?
It was a combination of several things. In the film, there is a woman by the name of Rebecca Johnson, who is a citizen of the UK, very actively involved in this topic. We were filming with her, and she said the words, in my lifetime, but also I feel that it's part of my life. I mean, I'm old enough to have experienced this from the very beginning, the duck and cover days. You mentioned that I'm from the Syracuse area. I mean, I went to Fayetteville Manlius High School, and I vividly remember the whole idea of duck and cover and all the stories going up to a hill outside of Fayetteville, being in a tower, looking for the planes coming over the horizon. So all these ideas in my lifetime, this unfolded, as well as the aspiration. And President Obama actually used the phrase, in my lifetime, although he said, when he announced in Prague the abolition of nuclear weapons, he made it quite clear, he said, in my lifetime, probably not. But still, so it's an aspirational title.
Yeah, I thought probably the Rebecca Johnson quote was what was at work there. But, you know, that part of the film led to another question for me. Despite that and despite the title, it seemed to me that the film might arguably have underplayed the role of anti-nuclear mass movements in thinking about this. And I was wondering if, in your view, you think that disarmament ultimately comes mainly from initiatives taken by leadership.
I think it's a combination. I feel that in the film, and incidentally, there is a feature-length version of the film that is available. And in that version, it is much more developed. But the point is you can't ignore the civil society, the role of civil society with this story. But I think the larger overarching theme has to do with what you just said. Governments still control this situation, specifically the 9 nuclear weapon states. Also with the UN, the non-proliferation treaty, of which 5 of the nuclear weapon state holders, the original as called P5, the U.S., now Russia, formerly Soviet Union, the U.K., France, and China, essentially control the decisions as to the whole idea of disarmament. Non-proliferation is another part of the treaty, as well as the conundrum of the treaty, of course, is all states have the inalienable right to have nuclear power plants. So there's that great dichotomy at work as well.
Yeah, I want to come back and explore a couple of those things you just mentioned in a bit. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with the producer and director of the documentary film In My Lifetime. And in fact, come back to something you just mentioned about your experiences growing up here in the Syracuse area. One of the things that struck me was in the film that several subjects talk at various points about how people of a certain age all have some kind of personal relation to nuclear weapons, some kind of personal experience with them. And you mentioned yours. I know that's true, too, for me growing up. I was wondering if you could say a bit more about that and how it relates to the ability to get people to think about disarmament and to make the case you're trying to make.
First, anyone over of a certain age, of which I am one, and I think you're probably on the cusp of that, have in their bones strontium 90. Why? In the late 40s and the 50s, well into the 60s, nuclear weapon tests took place in the atmosphere. NPR, I know when I first started this project in 2008, 2009, there was a radio story about a study done by scientists where they took samples of trees from all over the world, and they found tree rings, literally everywhere, had strontium 90 in the tree rings during that period of time. So we all own it in a way, I suppose, carrying it around in our bodies. But I think the larger issue is we can't just continue to be silent about this. As you recall in the film, and you mentioned this, civil society in the early 80s, there was a vast movement, the anti-nuclear weapon movement that took place. I think that still, in today's terms, was one of the important eras when it came to the work of civil society. But also, as my travels have taken me around the world, and on the website, incidentally, thenuclearworld.org, you'll notice a lot of organizations listed. There are people still very much at work today. They are doing what they can to call attention as well as to resolve the issues.
And what do you think is the most important thing today that most Americans don't know about nuclear weapons?
The fact that they still exist, the fact that we need to understand that this is not just a U.S. issue, but it's a global issue, but we have a role to play. I mean, in the speech, one of the speeches that Mr. Obama gave, he said, we started it, and it's our responsibility to do something about it. I think that is true. I mean, obviously, the history of this goes back to the 30s when Neil Szilard went to meet Albert Einstein and told Einstein, you know, there's a danger that Germany's producing the nuclear, at that time they called it the atomic bomb. And so he convinced Einstein to write a letter to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which they did in 1939. And the notion of being informed then, and it took 2 years, actually, took 3 years before the U.S. actually did anything about it in active terms by creating the Manhattan Project. And I think that this notion that we can just sort of idly not deal with this except to allow the continuing existence of the nuclear weapon complex without calling it to attention. You know, I don't know what the decisions should be taken, can be, or what how it unfolds. But the purpose of the film really is to let people know that this still is an issue, the grand struggle.
I'm talking with Bob Fry. He's the producer and director of In My Lifetime, a documentary about nuclear arms and the struggle for disarmament. Let me come back to some of the facts that you were citing before earlier in our conversation. Where are we currently on nuclear arms control and reduction in real terms, real on-the-ground terms?
Well, first of all, the treaty that was signed by President Obama with then-President Medvedev in Prague reduced the number of operational weapons. I think the number is 1550. Now, that is just the number that they're going to reduce down to that operationally are available. Obviously, a lot of this information beyond by the way, there is nothing in the film that is, quote, secret or top secret. Everything is in the public domain. It's a matter of pulling it together. But, you know, this notion that that's all we have is not correct. There are a lot of materials, there are weapons, there are arsenals, and in the film, you remember the sequence that Paul Schambrum photographed, and the row of those weapons. There are a lot like that around, not only in this country, but around the world. And I think it was a rather unique perspective because it sort of put a fact to the existence of these weapons. And he was given permission by the Defense Department to film, to photograph those. And I felt it was important in the film to show what they are. But ultimately, the weapons themselves, they're not, it's not the most dangerous part of this story. The most dangerous part of the story is what do human beings do with these weapons? And to me, it's a window into the larger idea of war and peace. And I feel it's important to get an understanding of this. And I certainly think also for the younger generations who really don't have a connection with the story. I think it's important, and I've shown it now to college students, and they get it. It's just that can they pause long enough or be given the opportunity to understand what this is about? And I think that's an essential part of my mission, to be able to take the time to show the film to them and have discussions about what they can do in the future.
Well, another piece in the movie concerns the relationship between the nuclear threat and nuclear power. And nuclear power has enjoyed a renaissance of popularity in some circles in recent years, despite the accidents. How do you see the relationship between the nuclear threat and nuclear power?
As the French nuclear physicist says in the film, the nexus really is that nuclear power, when it was originally created, was for the purpose of creating fissile materials with the two plants, Hanford, where they produced the plutonium, and Oak Ridge, where they produced the uranium that were used in the bombs. The uranium was used for the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. And then the plutonium was used, first of all, the test in southern New Mexico on July 16, 1945. 21 days later, the bombs dropped on Hiroshima. 3 days after that, the bomb is dropped on Nagasaki, which was a plutonium pit. By the way, the size of the pit of the explosive material, but essentially you can hold the pit of a bomb in your hand. Mm-hmm. And this is not classified information. It's readily available. And so if you have this massive material available, and it gets back to your initial question about nuclear power and nuclear weapons, the nexus is that nuclear power plants originally haven't been created for the purpose of fissile materials. It was only in 1952 when Dwight Eisenhower announced the Atoms for Peace program. It was almost an afterthought. Well, let's use the nuclear power plants to do something other than create materials for the bombs. It is an ongoing challenge and, as you know, an ongoing debate about the safety of nuclear power plants, not only in this country but around the world. And at the same time, within the treaty, the NPT treaty, you have the three tenets that I mentioned before, the first being disarmament, which means those that have the weapons need to disarm. Two, a nonproliferation, the aspiration that all countries around the world should not be developing the bombs. Three, nuclear power. Everyone has the inalienable right to build nuclear power plants. Of, I think there are 31 countries now that have nuclear power plants. In comes to this equation the IAEA, and their idea is that they have to provide the security, if you will, by going around and making sure that all the nuclear power plants are being used for what they say they're going to be used. Now, obviously, you bring in Iran. You bring in North Korea. And those are the two present examples of countries where this issue comes up. But in both cases, they use the inalienable right. In fact, the United States was very instrumental in introducing nuclear power in Iran when the Shah was in power. So now it's a question of, well, who has the control of that? Of course, when the Ayatollah Khomeini came along and overthrew the Shah, suddenly all of this knowledge and material is not necessarily in the hands of people that are friendly to the United States.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Bob Fry, the producer and director of the documentary film In My Lifetime. A couple personal questions about making the film. In the making of it, was there a particular experience or person you encountered that has stayed with you the most?
Well, when you meet the Abaka Shah, those that survived the bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you can't help but be impressed by two things. The fact that they survived, because the number that were killed in both places was enormous. People wiped out in an instant. Not even traces of their bones, if you will. But also just the way their mission, I mean, those that are in the film, obviously, are the ones that are willing to talk about this. Some of the Abaka Shah are not. And I think that they made an impression on me just in terms of their dedication. But, I think the larger issue for me, all the people that are in this film and whatever their role, they care about this story. Now, those are people that are either activists working to find a way to abolish the nuclear weapons. And by the way, this is not, I don't feel any longer, just a political issue. It's not whether you're a Republican or Democrat or conservative or liberal, because I think with the introduction of the Four Horsemen's op-ed pieces in the Wall Street Journal, that, for me, comes off the table. So there has been this call by politicians, not necessarily those in power at the moment, because there is this other grand conundrum. The moment one becomes president of the United States, and I think it's equivalent in Russia because we are still on 24/7 alert with the Russians, the first possession, if you will, that the president of the United States gets is the black bag mm-hmm. with accompanying military officer who is with him 24/7. That has the codes for the use of nuclear weapons. So this is the burden that one has when they become president of the United States, and the equivalent in Russia as well. So you have all of these ideas that commingle with how this continues to unfold in that respect.
Let me come back to the title. How hopeful are you that that title, In My Lifetime, will be realized? I mean, watching your film, I wasn't really that hopeful at the end that we'll see ever the end of these weapons.
I guess my only answer is I wouldn't make the film if I have something on the wall in my office to be positive, to take action. Negative, sit down. So I think that my goal, and actually I think the fact that the film is being aired and being received around the country, most public television stations are airing this film, many in prime time. You know, there's an instinct, I think, that the story has to be told. And, I mean, when I started filming in 2008, people said, why are you telling this story? I mean, you know, we have them. That's the end of the story. I don't believe that. If I did, I would have sat down and not done it. The idea of hope, I mean, I there was an op-ed piece that was published in the USA Today beginning of May, and I started to read the responses, and I realized I wasn't going to win this argument because I was called everything from naive right on through. But that's not the issue. What I'm trying to do is stimulate a dialogue and to have people, number one, aware of what's going on, two, if they can be informed by watching the film and understand the complexity of it. Three, for the younger generations, particularly to educate them to the fact that this exists. The third mantra I have on the website is activate. Now, that's a choice that everyone can make on their own. I think it calls for a wide-ranging debate. That's really the purpose of the film.
Well, let me get to the three questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
Still working. And the aspiration really is I feel that I'm telling this story and I need to continue doing that.
Second, what's your worst trait?
Can be too sensitive. And I'm in a terrible business for that, but that's what it is.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
You know, I would have a very difficult answer to that because I feel I express gratitude every day. And I do that because the miracle of creation, and you know this from your work as well, if we have the ability to create, there is no one thing that I can really point to. I mean, I could go through a range of ideas, but I think philosophically it's more about being able to create. That's, to me, the miracle of this work that I do.
That was Bob Fry. And again, the film is In My Lifetime, and it's airing on WCNY this Friday at 10 p.m. Bob, thanks so much for talking with me.
I appreciate the opportunity, and may I say hello to people in Syracuse.
You can. You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher. Associate producers include Bethany Wallowender, Kelly Coleman, John Fornoff, Stephanie Lee, Hennish Pullickle, and Sophia Celeste Tate, and recording engineer Tom Fazio. For more information on the Campbell Conversations, visit WRVO.org.